Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the New York Public Library. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers. And I just want to say how glad we all are that you're here. The order of things is I'm going to, in a minute, turn the microphone over to Dan Kevlis, who's a professor of history at Yale and is a fellow in residence at the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers this year, and is an advisor to the estate of Eric Goldman. And it's the estate of Eric Goldman that endowed this lecture series, the first one of which you're going to hear tonight, the first lecture. So Dan will explain a little bit about that, then I will come back and introduce the speaker for tonight, and then she'll speak. So we'll try to make all that very quick, so you can get on to the whole reason you came. Dan?
Thank you, Jean, and I'm so much looking forward to the lecture this evening, as you are, by Frankie Fitzgerald, on a subject of huge interest and influence in the United States. I wanted to, as Jean said, to tell you something about the provenance of these lectures. Joanna Jackson Goldman, whom the lecture series honors, was the wife of the writer and historian Eric F. Goldman, who was very prominent in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Joe died in April 1980 when she was in her 50s. She was a victim of the severe strain that she suffered as a result of a grave stroke that had struck Eric a month earlier. After he recovered, he resolved to memorialize Joe, and he talked about what might be done with many people, including me. Eric Goldman had been my professor at Princeton. I had taken my doctorate under him, and he had guided me with great generosity when I was a young writer and historian, with the result that I had become a close friend of both him and Joe Goldman. However, much though we talked about the memorial for Joe, by the time of his death in 1989, he had not yet hit upon something that he considered suitable and appropriate. Part of the reason that Eric had been stymied was that he strongly suspected that Joe would have been mortified to be memorialized. She was a very modest woman who hated to be celebrated except in the intimate circles of friends and family. However, I had promised Eric that I would advise his estate upon the creation of a memorial, and I had no hesitation in making good on the promise because, in my view, Joanna Goldman thoroughly deserved celebration. She was a native of Charleston, West Virginia, a minister's daughter with a stirring soprano voice who loved music and books. She went to Miami University in Ohio during World War II. Her fiancé, a high school sweetheart, was killed in the Battle of the Bulge. When she graduated, she set off for a new life in post-war New York City in the late 40s and there met Eric Goldman. At the time, he was working on the book that became Rendezvous with Destiny, his powerful and influential history of reform in modern America. Joe was fascinated by the project and assisted Eric in it, spending hours outside of her regular job digging out material here in this wonderful library. She was a remarkable woman, courageous, iconoclastic, and compelling, with a radiant inner strength. Eric told me that she once quieted a raucous Christmas Eve crowd at Marie's Crisis, the Greenwich Village nightclub, where she performed by singing Silent Night a cappella in her unaccompanied and transfixing voice. In finally deciding how to memorialize her, we, and by that I mean Alan Porter, the executor of the Goldman Estate, and myself, and Alan is here, I'm pleased to say, this evening with his wife, we were guided by one of her other high devotions, and that is a powerful faith in the United States, in the promise of its democratic principles, and an acute awareness not only of the battles won, but of those still to be fought to realize its promise for all of its peoples. Joe herself was very much a part of the history of the United States in her own day, an era, of course, of depression and uneasy affluence, of war and then Cold War. She greatly admired people who tried to find their way and the way for their country through the turmoil and confusion with the aid of the discourse of ideas. She loved few things better than an animated debate over the dinner table, part of what she and Eric thought of as their ongoing and endless seminar. In a sense, then, it was Jo Goldman herself, with her love of this country, her acute awareness of its deficiencies, past and present, and her belief that they could be rectified if only people would stop long enough to think, that led us to conceive the memorial lecture series that brings us together this evening. I am grateful to Alan Porter for his wise guidance, the guidance he has provided the Memorial Project throughout. The Goldman Estate is especially grateful to Paul LeClaire, the head of the New York Public Library, for agreeing instantly when we first approached him with the idea for this lecture series that it would be a worthy venture for the library. The estate is also indebted to Paul Holdengraber for managing the lecture series here for several years, and now especially to Jean Strauss, the director of the Coleman Center, for having taken over that responsibility from Paul. It is therefore a special pleasure to return the podium to Jean, the director of the Coleman Center, who will introduce Frankie Fitzgerald, this year's Joanna Jackson Goldman Memorial Lecture. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. I also want to include Betsy Bradley in your gratitude and my own for how all the work she's done to put this program together, the last series of Goldman Lectures, and all the public programs that we do. So before I introduce Frances Fitzgerald, I'm going to tell you briefly about the other programs Betsy's organized for this spring. On April 7th, we will host a panel called Mumbai, Terror and Islamism, taking off from the events in Mumbai last fall and looking at their contexts and consequences. The panel will consist of three Coleman Center fellows, Hari Kunzru and Akhil Belgrami, a novelist and a philosopher, both of whom are here this year, and Pankaj Mishra, a journalist and writer of many kinds of things, who was a former fellow. They will be talking together with the Pakistani writer Fauzia Afzal Khan. That's April 7th. There are orange flyers as you leave on a table that will tell you about all these events. On April 30th, another former Coleman Center fellow, T.J. Stiles, will be talking with the novelist Kevin Baker about Stiles' new book, The First Tycoon, a biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt, which he worked on while he was here. On May 13th, the graphic novelist and former Coleman Center fellow, Ben Katchor, who is a delightful person in all ways, and his a partner, he works with the composer, Mark Mulcahy, will put on the premiere performance of their new musical theater piece, A Czech Room Romance. This piece was commissioned by the Coleman Center, so whenever it's performed from now on, it will have the Coleman Center's name attached to it. If you've never seen a Katchor Mulcahy musical piece, I cannot recommend it highly enough, and even if you have seen one, come to this one. Finally, on May 27th, another former Coleman Center fellow, the novelist Danzy Senna, will be talking with the memoir writer Rebecca Walker about Danzy's new nonfiction book called Where Did You Sleep Last Night? It's a personal history which looks both back at the families of her Boston Brahmin mother and her African-American father, and her own experiences growing up in that family. So, as I said, you'll find orange flyers about all that by the exit as you leave, and also a sign-up sheet. So if you're not already on our email list to find out about our upcoming programs, please give us your email and we'll keep you posted. Finally, it's a great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, the brilliant writer Frances Fitzgerald. Her first book, which she published in her early 30s, was Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam, and it won a trifecta of awards, the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the Bancroft Prize in American History from Columbia. In that book, as in what she'll be talking about tonight and for the next 2 weeks, she found astonishingly fresh ways to look at subjects people thought they knew well. And I think you'll hear that tonight. Next, she took a sharp critical look at how history gets taught in American high schools in her book, America Revised, History Textbooks in the 20th Century. If I do any more than list the rest of her books, we won't have time for her lecture. So the others include Cities on a Hill, A Journey Through Contemporary American Cultures, which was published in 1987, and Way Out There in the Blue, Reagan, Star Wars, and the End of the Cold War, published in 2000. Fitzgerald writes for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books and has written for each of those publications over many years about the changing face of American evangelicalism. The title of her talk under that general heading tonight is appropriately introductory, Who Are the Evangelicals? I'm certain we're in for an extraordinary hour. There'll be a little time at the end for questions. So now please welcome Frances Fitzgerald.
Thank you very much, Jean. I see time is getting along a bit, so I think I'm going to skip the preface. But the preface was merely to say that I think most educated New Yorkers, and I learned this from my numerous doctors. Doctors are so specialized now. You have to go about six every year just for checkups, and all of them say. They ask me what I'm working on, and I say evangelicals, and they say, the evangelicals terrify me. So they equate evangelicals with the religious right, and since they're very educated New Yorkers, I suspect that just about everybody else does as well. And it's not entirely without reason, because religious right leaders have had the most powerful voices in the evangelical community for almost 30 years. And in recent presidential elections, including the one just passed, over 70% of evangelicals voted Republican. Right-wing evangelical leaders, from Jerry Falwell to James Dobson, have claimed credit for those Republican votes. And further, they've tended to speak as if they represent the community as a whole. So to many Americans, the word evangelical conjures up a whole lot of people railing against liberals, secular humanists, homosexuals, abortion, and the teaching of evolution in the public schools. But such a view is inaccurate. Evangelicals are hardly identical with the religious right, and since 2004, moderate evangelical leaders have been making this distinction clear by sort of publicly airing their differences with the religious right. Some have attacked the right directly. Others have simply proposed a different political agenda, arguing that Christians ought to engage with issues such as global warming and systemic poverty at home and abroad. For the first time in more than a quarter of a century, evangelicals are engaging in a lively public debate about the relationship of church and state, and also about morality. What is a moral issue and what isn't? I think this debate is one of considerable importance to the rest of us, because white evangelicals, after all, make up 25% of the population of the United States, 25% of the voting public. 25%. Well, next week I'll be talking about the religious right and where it came from, and the following one about the so-called the new evangelicals, this group that is disputing the right. But there's really no understanding either phenomenon without focusing on who evangelicals are and what makes them different from other Protestants, from so-called mainline Protestants. Evangelicals are, after all, a religious group and not a political one, and Jimmy Carter is as much of an evangelical as Sarah Palin. Well, the word evangelical, as I'm sure many of you know, comes from the Greek word evangelion, meaning the gospels or the good news. And in this sort of root sense of the word, all Christians are evangelicals. But the word has been appropriated and hijacked, if you will, over time by successive Christian movements. And so the meaning of it has gradually narrowed. During the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther appropriated the word, calling his new church Evangelische. And for centuries, the word evangelical signified all Protestants. But in the 18th century, the word was appropriated again, this time by pietistic Protestants such as the Methodists, who created a series of revivals that swept across the English-speaking world. American evangelicals today claim to be the true inheritors of those revivals and of the Protestant Reformation. The term, in other words, has a polemical quality to it, and it's never been stable. In the past 30 or 40 years, it has come to connote a wide variety of religiously conservative Protestants. Most pollsters, those who we rely upon for our statistics, define evangelicals today as those who stress the need for a spiritual new birth, emphasize the authority of the Bible, stress the saving character of Jesus' death on the cross, and encourage spreading the Gospels. The definition is a vague one, and necessarily because there's no bright doctrinal line separating evangelicals from so-called mainline Protestants, and the group is theologically diverse. For example, evangelicals include Pentecostals, who believe that the Holy Spirit continues to work miracles among us, plus members of Reformed churches, who believe in Calvinist doctrines of predestination and election. Evangelical denominations include the 16 million member Southern Baptist Convention, as well as numerous small groups such as the Mennonite Brethren. Many evangelicals belong to non-denominational churches, and some of these are so-called seeker churches, which aim to attract people who really don't have much of a religious background. Pollsters, in fact, differ in their classification of some churches, and they put African-American evangelicals into a separate category, not just because they vote differently, but because their religious traditions are different. David Bebbington, a distinguished evangelical scholar, writes of evangelicalism as a set of four impulses: conversionism, or emphasis on the new birth, biblicism, crucicentrism, and activism, or concern for sharing the faith with others. But evangelicals express these impulses in different ways. According to polls, some 60% are biblical literalists, who believe, for example, that God created the universe in exactly 6 days a few thousand years ago, and who insist that their interpretation of the Bible is the eternal and only true reading of it. Others believe, as most mainline Protestants do, that the Bible should be read in the light of the rest of human knowledge, and that its interpretation is not a simple matter. Evangelicals tend to be more active than mainline Protestants in their efforts to propagate their faith, and most of their churches and denominations support missions abroad. But personally, many evangelicals are content with so-called lifestyle evangelism. That is, just being a good example of a Christian to others. I think if there's a single characteristic that sets pious evangelicals off from mainline Protestants, it's surely the depth of their involvement with the supernatural. Still, not all of them would say, as Sarah Palin did last year, of her biggest project in Alaska. I think God's will has to be done in unifying people and companies to get the gas line built. Evangelicals also vary in their political attitudes. Surveys taken since the 80s show that they're more conservative than the population as a whole on economic issues and in terms of foreign policy. They tend to be more unilateralist. Some on the religious right favor a free market totally unfettered by government restrictions and an aggressive militarized foreign policy. Yet almost half of all evangelicals are no more conservative than Americans generally, except on abortion and gay rights. And even on these issues, they're far more moderate than the religious right. Mainline Protestant clergymen find much about evangelicals exotic. They look askance at the evangelical megachurches with their enormous video screens and their Christian rock and roll music. They wonder about the pastors of huge churches who lack seminary training. They find it hard to understand the emphasis evangelical pastors put on the conversion experience and the statistics they keep on the number of people saved in their churches. They're puzzled by their focus on sexual morality as opposed to other moral concerns. and the list could go on. But probably what puzzles and frankly annoys them the most is that the tendency of evangelicals to speak as if only they were Christians. But then evangelicals are in many ways closer to the historical roots of Protestantism in this country. In this country, evangelicalism dates from the revivals of the 18th and 19th centuries, known as the First and Second Great Awakenings. Those revivals coursed through all the existing denominations, created new ones, and turned almost all American Protestants into evangelicals, this in Bebington's strict sense of the word. Evangelicalism became the dominant cultural force in the country, and what the historian Martin Marty calls the evangelical empire lasted until the end of the 19th century. For most Protestants in that period, America was a Christian, read Protestant, nation guided by providence and a model for mankind. Free enterprise and republicanism, with a small r, were seen as part of that model. Each individual was responsible for his or her own fate. The Bible was central to intellectual life, and plain common sense the intellectual standard. But in the latter part of the 19th century, new currents of thought coursed through the northern churches, among them Darwinian evolution, the historical analysis of biblical texts, and the idea that poverty was a structural issue that required structural reform. In the 1920s, Protestant conservatives waged a bitter struggle against modernist thinking and social Christianity, but the new thinking gradually took hold in the major denominations in the North. From that time on, many evangelicals have seen themselves as an outcast minority and a saving remnant, keeping Christianity and the American tradition alive. The battle waged between liberals and conservatives during the 1920s is generally thought of as the root cause of the split within American Protestantism. I now think that the beginning of this division came well before the Civil War, and that it formed the context for the crack-up that came later on. In any case, evangelicalism really can only be understood by going back to the transformation wrought by in American Protestantism by the two Great Awakenings. Awakenings, as the scholar William McLaughlin tells us, are periods of cultural revitalization that extend over a period of a generation or so, during which time a profound reorientation in beliefs and values takes place. The First Great Awakening began in the 1730s among Congregationalists and Presbyterians, the direct heirs to the Puritans, at the beginning of a social and cultural crisis. In New England, the Puritans had established close-knit communities bound by covenant in which church and state cooperated to build a holy commonwealth. Calvinists, they believed that God, who was unreachable and unknowable, determined everything that went on in his creation. They believed that human nature was totally corrupt and had been since Adam's fall. God, in their view, had reason to condemn all mankind to hell, but because of Christ's atoning sacrifice on the cross, he had decided to grant salvation to an elect few. Men might come to hope that they were among the elect and to experience an infusion of his grace. But whatever God willed, men had a duty to help each other and to obey the laws of the community and respect its authorities. Puritan society was stratified and patriarchal. In the preface to the covenant signed on the Arbella, John Winthrop wrote, "God Almighty, in his most holy and wise providence, hath so disposed of the conditions of mankind, as in all times some must be rich and some poor, some eminent in power and dignity, and others mean and in subjection." Man's duty was thus to accept his station within this God-given hierarchy. By the 18th century, this Puritan order faced both social and ideological challenges. Congregationalism remained the established religion in New England, yet the immigration of other Christians and non-believers had ended the Puritan control of the polity. In addition, The westward movement of the settlers and the growing wealth and independence of landowners and merchants had bred a new spirit of individualism. As a result, the voluntary covenants broke down. Religion became more of a formality, more of a matter of church membership than of pious obedience. At the same time, Enlightenment ideas circulated among educated people, causing some to doubt fundamental Calvinist doctrines such as human depravity and predestination. Congregationalist clergymen preached angry sermons about God's judgment on those who failed to keep the covenants, and many people, unable to fit their lives into the old pattern, were haunted by a sense of guilt. The New England revivals began in a citadel of Orthodox Calvinism, the Church of Jonathan Edwards in Northampton, Massachusetts. The son and grandson of Congregationalist clergy, Edwards had studied science and read the works of John Locke and Isaac Newton at Yale. As a theologian, he used the methods of the Enlightenment thinkers to defend Calvinism from the clergy who were swayed by Enlightenment humanism. In 1734, when Edwards was giving a series of sermons on justification by faith, an outbreak of religious fervor occurred in his parish. People laughed and wept, and some saw visions. And in the space of 6 months, 300 people were converted, bringing the total membership of his church to 600, which is almost the total population of this adult population of this town. And visitors came to his church, and revival spread to towns up and down the Connecticut River, and then to other parts of New England. Edwards was puzzled by this. He called this a surprising work of God. But what had he done to trigger it? He'd given sermons about the wrath of God, as his forebears had done, but he concluded them always with a general offer of grace. Christ, he said in his famous sermon, has flung the doors of mercy wide open and stands at the door calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners. In effect, Edwards had cracked open the gates of Calvinism with the evangelical message that God would save not just the obviously pious and worthy, not just the ministers and magistrates, but all who would receive his grace. And though an intellectual, Edwards believed that religion began with an emotional experience, with a change of heart. Well, the revivals continued among the Congregationalists in New England and among the Presbyterians, descendants of the Scotch-Irish Puritans who'd settled largely in the middle colonies. But with the arrival of the English evangelist George Whitfield in 1739, the revivals spread throughout the country. Though far less well known than Edwards today, Whitfield was an extraordinary figure. An Oxford graduate and an Anglican minister, he had a powerful voice, a dramatic preaching style, and an ability to simplify church doctrines for a mass audience. He had studied acting when he was young, and David Garrick, the greatest actor of the day, said that he could seize the attention of any crowd just by pronouncing the word Mesopotamia. At Oxford, he'd met John and Charles Wesley, the founders of a pietistic movement within the Anglican Church called Methodism. Whitfield had theological differences with the Wesleys. He was a Calvinist. But like John, he had had a profound religious experience that banished all doubts he ever had about his own salvation. This experience, which he called a new birth, became his criterion for conversion. And with the Wesleys, he established it as a staple of revivalist preaching. In 1740, Whitfield spent a year in America, traveling up and down the eastern seaboard, preaching in the major cities and towns. He was only 23 years old, but his sermons had already caused a sensation in London, and he drew crowds of thousands to his open-air meetings. Benjamin Franklin, the skeptic, never believed he could do this, but he watched closely at Whitfield's open-air meeting in Philadelphia and was totally swayed by the man, if not the message. With the help of the media of the day, the newspapers that heralded his arrival, and the printers who published his sermon, Whitfield became the first intercolonial celebrity. An inspiration to local preachers, he also became the catalyst for a countrywide revivalist movement. This movement soon developed a radical wing led by itinerant revivalists whose preaching caused extreme reactions, screaming, fainting, convulsions, and so forth. These radicals claimed that only those who'd been through a crisis conversion had the right to preach. They attacked the Orthodox clergy as unconverted Pharisees, men only concerned with wealth and status, men so conceited about their learning that they looked upon the common people with an air of disdain. Clearly, there was an element of social rebellion here. The Orthodox clergy quite naturally reacted, and the controversy split the denominations. The evangelical Presbyterians quit the Philadelphia Synod. The radical Congregationalists founded separate churches, and some became Baptists. These separates, as they were called, proved as troublesome to the civil authorities as to the clergy, for they demanded exemption from the taxes that supported the Congregationalist church. And when they were turned down, they practiced civil disobedience and petitioned for the right of religious dissent. After the revolution, they became leaders in the movement for the separation of church and state. In the meantime, in the 1740s, some of these separate Baptists, along with some of the revivalist Presbyterians, set out to evangelize the South. There they faced small resistance. The Anglican Church was the established church in most of the southern colonies, but it depended from the Church of England. It had very few resources, and it didn't even have a bishop. Those few churches that flourished were essentially fiefdoms of the local gentry and completely identified with a class system that sharply differentiated aristocrats from common people and, of course, from slaves. Then, of course, by the mid-18th century, the expansion of settlement had left many Southerners outside the sphere of organized religion. So Baptists and Presbyterians, later joined by some of the first Methodist missionaries to come to this country, filled the vacuum. They proselytized among the small farmers and tradesmen, and also among enslaved Africans, with considerable success. After the Revolution, evangelicals combined with free thinkers like Jefferson and Madison to bring religious freedom to Virginia. The revivals of the First Great Awakening trailed off in the 1760s, though evangelical sects continued to proselytize. The American Revolution intervened. Then, just at the turn of the 19th century, the Second Great Awakening began with a spectacular series of revivals in Kentucky and Tennessee. One camp meeting in Kentucky drew about 20,000 people, an awful lot for the sparsely populated territory, and it lasted almost a week. Emotions ran high, with some people laughing uncontrollably, others singing or dancing or falling down in faints. And after that, revivals broke out around the region with people longing to have the same intense spiritual experience. The Second Great Awakening was even more explosive than the first, and it took place in a time of rapid social and economic and political change. In 1790, almost all of the American settlers lived within the original 13 colonies. By 1850, almost a half lived outside of them in the states and territories to the west. Meanwhile, the population grew at an astonishing rate, going from 2.5 million to 20 million in the 70 years following the revolution, and this virtually without immigration. In 1790, almost all white Americans were of English or Scots-Irish descent and Protestants by background. So not long after the revolution, revivalist preachers, most of them Methodists, Baptists, and breakaway Presbyterians, set out to church the unchurched on the frontiers. In this burgeoning country, the Federalist vision of a society ruled by educated landowners and merchants soon became obsolete. So did the Puritan Calvinist worldview. As the historian Nathaniel O. Hatch has shown, the frontier revivalists participated in the upheavals of the post-revolutionary period and the struggle to create a more egalitarian society. To reach their audiences in a world without schools or churches, they developed new methods of proselytization and a simplified form of evangelism, a populist folk religion. Frontier evangelists gained authority not by virtue of their seminary degrees, but by their ability to appeal to mass audiences. Unlike the settled clergy, they preached in a colloquial language, used earthy humor, and common sense reasoning. Storytellers rather than didactic moralists, they dramatized biblical stories and vividly described the torments of hell. Of Lorenzo Dow, an independent Methodist and one of the most popular preachers of the day, one contemporary wrote, "His weapons against Beelzebub were providential interpositions, wondrous disasters, touching sentiments, miraculous escapes. A raging storm might be the forerunner of God's immediate wrath. A change of elements might betoken paradise restored or a new Jerusalem. He might be farcical or funereal. He had a genius at all times to construct a catastrophe." Some of the most popular frontier preachers championed popular sovereignty and the cause of the backwoods people against merchants and land speculators. Some were radical Jeffersonians who spoke of the rights of man and the liberty of conscience. Lorenzo Dow, for one, condemned the distinction made between gentlemen and peasants and called upon people to throw off the shackles of deference and think for themselves. In the more settled parts of the country, revivalists inveighed against the wealth and pretensions of the genteel clergy. In particular, they attacked the Orthodox Calvinist clergy for their assumption of cultural authority and their arcane philosophical systems. The leaders of some of the evangelical groups, like Francis Asbury, who was the first American bishop in the Methodist Church, actually contended that the Protestant Reformation had not gone far enough. Lumping Puritan Calvinism along with Catholicism, they called for a return to the primitive church of the apostles. Sola Scriptura, no creed but the Bible, had been a tenet of Protestantism since Martin Luther, but some of the frontier revivalists took this to mean that each individual had a right to his own interpretation of the Bible. One of them, Alexander Campbell, urged that the traditional distinction between the clergy and the laity be abolished so that people could read the plain facts of the Bible themselves. To the Orthodox clergy, religious freedom seemed to be leading to a situation in which any demagogue could stand up on a soapbox, in which popular opinion would decide the truth, and in which religious anarchy would prevail. In fact, some denominations, the Presbyterians for one, did split apart, and though some of them only temporarily. New religious movements did spring up, notably the Disciples of Christ, the Mormons, and a group that later became the Seventh-day Adventists. But by and large, the Methodists and the Baptists dominated the preaching circuits and made most of the frontier conversions. The Methodists, with their circuit riders who traveled the country on horseback, the Baptists with their self-supporting farmer preachers who moved into new areas and gathered new congregations. These men were young, poor, and had no more formal education than the people they served. In the course of their work, they and breakaway Presbyterians developed a common form of evangelicalism, a simplified system well adapted to frontier society. Calvinism formed the backdrop to this system, but key doctrines played no role in it. Predestination had never had much appeal to those at the lower end of the social scale because of the implication that God ordained poverty and human suffering. The Methodists, who had worked among the poor in an industrializing England, had rejected this doctrine from the beginning, along with the idea that God would save only an elect few. the Baptists and the Presbyterians tried to uphold some of these Calvinist doctrines. But as Enlightenment thinking about human nature became a part of the American atmosphere, these doctrines seemed more and more to defy common sense. Further, they proved poor tools for evangelism in the egalitarian world of the frontier. So, not long after 1800, the evangelicals abandoned them in favor of free will and salvation for all who chose it. Brought down to earth and stripped of theological complexity, the evangelical message was clear and urgent. You sinners are lost without God and condemned to hell, but if you repent and open your heart to his grace, you will live in a sweet, close relationship with God and gain everlasting life. As the historian Samuel Hill wrote, Christianity, thus interpreted, was a problem-solution system. This folk religion proved extraordinarily successful in the South and the Southwest. Methodists, Presbyterians, Baptists evangelized from Virginia to Florida and west from Missouri to Texas. By 1850, most Protestants in this entire region belonged to one of these three denominations. These groups made huge strides in the rest of the country as well. By 1850, more than a third of all religious adherents in the country were Methodists. About 20% were Baptists and 12% Presbyterians. Even in New England, the Methodists became the second largest denomination. All the same, the New England Congregationalists and Presbyterians, with their strong theological traditions, gave evangelicalism a very different character in the North than it had in the South. In the early years of the century, Timothy Dwight, the president of Yale, and other learned Calvinists denounced the evangelical methods as barbarous and opined that unlettered preachers could not arrest human depravity or stand as pillars of the civilization. But to him, the most serious threat to the Christian order came from the Unitarians based at Harvard, who preached a liberal, rationalist form of Protestantism, attractive to educated people steeped in Enlightenment thinking. Dwight gathered a group of Yale students, among them Nathaniel W. Taylor and Lyman Beecher, to mount an intellectual defense of Calvinism and to reinvigorate the churches. He got more than he asked for. A theologian of considerable brilliance, Taylor revisited all the issues that Jonathan Edwards had tackled, and by 1820 came up with conclusions more in keeping with Enlightenment humanism. Man had free will, and though disposed to sin, he could choose to act virtuously, and he could choose salvation. Taylor had, in other words, come to some of the conclusions that the Methodists had, but he had reached them within a systematic theology and a new account of human psychology. Later, Taylorism, or the New School theology, entered the textbooks of moral science, used in schools and colleges, and formed the basis for Protestant education for many years to come. In the immediate, it permitted Lyman Beecher, an activist preacher and an organizer, to prepare New England Congregationalists and Presbyterians to compete both with the Unitarians and with the Methodists. In evangelical fashion, he organized revivals of a decorous sort through Connecticut and into the Unitarian strongholds of Boston and Cambridge. As converts were made, he and his associates enlisted them into voluntary associations to work for causes such as temperance, an end to dueling, and missions to the Midwest. At first, these associations were conservative in spirit and devoted to puritanical moral reform, but they grew more socially engaged as the years went on, and as the New School theology became infected by the radical perfectionism of Charles Grandison Finney. Finney, who's another neglected figure in our history texts, was the single most influential preacher of his time. He had a sort of phenomenal career. In 1821, when he had an intense conversion experience, he was a practicing lawyer in upstate New York. 3 years later, he was attracting throngs to his revivals. And by 1830, he had become the most sought-after preacher in the country and the best-known revivalist since George Whitefield. A tall, gaunt man with blazing eyes, he preached, as the Methodists did, directly and dramatically in what he called the language of common life. But he was a Presbyterian, though he refused ministerial training. After his ordination, he adopted much of New School theology, but he went much further than Taylor in explicitly repudiating Calvinism and proposing free will as a simple God-given fact. In the early days of his revivals in upstate New York, Finney experimented with various methods of persuasion, as letting women pray out loud with men in the churches, and seating the wavering people who might or might not convert on an anxious bench in front of the stage. He incorporated the most successful of these new measures into his repertoire. A revival, he wrote, is not a miracle, nor dependent upon a miracle in any sense. It is a purely philosophical result of the right use of constituted means. It was, in other words, a science. In 1827, Finney brought his revivals into the cities, Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. These revivals, some of which went on for weeks, were meticulously organized. The cooperating churches did the advance work, putting up placards, advertising in the newspapers. Ministers were trained to follow up with the converts, and money was raised from wealthy laymen to cover the costs. Subsequent urban revivalists, from Billy Sunday to Billy Graham, added new techniques, but Finney established the pattern for them all. Still, it was Finney's message that inspired those who heard him, and for many, his perfectionist doctrines were just as thrilling as his promise of personal salvation. Like the Methodists, Finney preached that conversion was only the first step, and that the believer could, by strenuous efforts, obtain a second blessing and lead a sinless life in harmony with God. But like the Calvinists, he proposed that God's concern was not just for the salvation of individuals, but for his whole creation, human society and nature included. For Finney, regeneration meant a change from selfishness to benevolence, from having a supreme regard for one's own interests to dedicating oneself to advancing God's kingdom on earth and making it fit for the return of Christ. The focus for believers thus had to be outwards, to the conversion of others, but also to the reform of society as a whole. And in the wake of his revivals, Northern evangelicals initiated all the major reform movements of the 19th century. Among them were temperance, the reform of penal institutions and criminal law, the propagation of literacy, the establishment of free public schools, and an international peace movement. William Lloyd Garrison formed the American Anti-Slavery Society in Finney's New York church, and Theodore Weld, a convert of Finney's, led an abolitionist crusade in upstate New York in the mid-1830s that gave the abolitionist cause its first mass following. A few years later, evangelical anti-slavery activists, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, created the feminist movement. By the time the fires of the Second Great Awakening died down in the 1840s, almost all Americans had become evangelicals in Bebington's strict sense of that term. Yet the notion that the awakening created an evangelical Protestant consensus for the rest of the century really doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Certainly, the Union troops marching off to war, singing the battle hymn of the Republic, which was written by Lyman Beecher's daughter, could have testified to the limits of this evangelical consensus. The issue of slavery split all three major evangelical denominations. The Methodists and Baptists formally divided along regional lines because of it. Clearly, not all evangelicals were followers of Beecher and Finney, but that was not the end of their differences. As Samuel S. Hill, Donald G. Matthews, and other historians of the South have shown, evangelicalism developed so differently in the two regions of the country that even by the 1830s, Northern and Southern evangelicals did not agree on such fundamental issues as the role of the conversion experience. Many, but not all, of these differences arose because of the division over slavery. In the two decades after the American Revolution, the Methodists, Baptists, and Presbyterians opposed slavery. The Methodists, who made the most vigorous and successful attempts to convert enslaved Africans, were the most adamant in their opposition. In 1780, the General Conference of Preachers determined that slavery was, quote, contrary to the laws of God, man, and nature, hurtful to society, and contrary to the dictates of conscience and pure religion. The preachers ordered their circuit riders to free their slaves and urged all Methodists to do the same. 4 years later, they threatened to excommunicate all Methodists who did not free their slaves in 2 years. This was going too far. The order so enraged the Southern laity that it had to be rescinded. The circuit riders, plus some local Baptist and Presbyterian ministers, continued to preach against slavery, but to no effect. The number of slaves continued to increase with the expansion of cotton cultivation. In 1812, the Methodist General Conference essentially gave up and allowed its local conferences in the South to make their own regulations on slavery. And rather to fight a losing battle, a younger generation of preachers in the South turned their efforts to persuading slaveholders to improve conditions for their slaves, thus in effect sanctioning slavery. As Matthews points out, the evangelicals, unlike the Quakers, for example, were intent on converting as many people as possible and unwilling to make emancipation a condition for salvation. They ended by embracing the slaveholding system. Then, as their membership grew, they in effect became Southern society. In the 1830s, Lord Garrison and other Finney associates flooded the South with anti-slavery pamphlets, using evangelical language to preach the duty of emancipation. Under pressure from the abolitionists, Southern evangelical preachers came up with ever new arguments to defend their own moral position. Slavery was a civil institution outside the scope of the church. Slavery was biblical. Slavery was necessary to the economy of the South, and so forth. Northern evangelicals refused to countenance these arguments, and after denominational crises in 1844, Southern Methodists and Southern Baptists broke away and formed separate denominations. The Presbyterians had already split between conservatives and progressives, so the Southerners stayed with the conservatives. In any case, freed from the need to conciliate their Northern confreres, Southern evangelicals mounted a general defense of slavery based squarely on the notion of racial inequality. In the first two decades of the 19th century, Southern evangelicals had not only opposed slavery, but they'd launched a variety of reform movements, among them an end to imprisonment for indebtedness and the amelioration of prison conditions. But in the 1830s, all these reform movements came to a stop, because Southerners felt that challenging any facet of the social order might bring slavery itself into question. The claim that slavery was a civil institution outside the purview of the church then led to a comprehensive doctrine known as the spirituality of the church. Formally advanced by Presbyterians, the doctrine held that the church, as an order of grace, was permitted no official involvement in the social reform of the state, an order merely of justice. The church, in other words, should simply accept the status quo or whatever the politicians decided. This doctrine of the spirituality of the church reigned in the South for the next 150 years. In practice, the churches never completely abstained from social involvement. They agitated for temperance and for the blue laws. But the doctrine was invoked when the churches did not wish to deal with mere issues of justice, such as indeed issues of racial justice. The divergence between the evangelicals in the two regions extended to the way they defined the Christian life. In the North, perfectionism was widely taught, and conversion propelled evangelicals into the work of building God's kingdom on earth. As the struggle with self gave way to the struggle for social reform, Northern evangelicals reverted to what Samuel Hill calls the standard three-dimensional approach to religion, in which the ongoing life in the church was as basic as the entrance to it, and in which the Christian is always in the process of becoming a Christian. In sum, evangelicalism in the North became less evangelical. In the South, on the other hand, evangelism, or the saving of individual souls, remained the overriding concern and was understood to be the main contribution of the church to society. Conversion remained an anguished struggle with sin and guilt, and the experience the crux of an individual's religious life. Conversion involved joining the church and accepting its discipline, but morality, as the clergy preached it, had mainly to do with the individual's behavior in the context of family and church. It was a personal ethic, not a social one. In the North, the Second Great Awakening made Protestantism more theologically diverse. At Yale, Taylor and others continued to work out their New Light theology. Traditionalist Calvinists established themselves at Princeton. And out of Harvard's Unitarianism came Transcendentalism and the literary renaissance of New England, Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, and others. In the North, the awakening seemed to have a liberating effect on intellectual life. But in the South, still largely rural and agricultural, frontier evangelicalism gained a virtual monopoly on intellectual life, and basic church doctrines were simply taken for granted. What lay people learned was that the Bible was an infallible guide and that the church taught what was written in it. They further learned that biblical texts were to be taken literally, for only by such a reading could slavery be justified. Coming into contact with people who read the Bible differently, Southerners simply concluded that those others were not really Christians. They concluded that the South was the sacred community and the North the world that required conversion. Well, you can see how these attitudes on both sides fed into the Civil War. But here, it seems to me, lies the origins of the split between evangelical and mainline Protestants. Conservative evangelicals, of course, existed in the North as well as in the South, so the split wasn't entirely along regional lines. But given the relative isolation of the South after the Civil War, Southern evangelicalism survived almost intact until the mid-20th century. Then things began to change. When modernism and fundamentalism finally entered the Southern picture. As transformed by these two new movements, modernism, fundamentalism, the Southern religion produced Jimmy Carter on one hand, and much of the constituency of the religious right on the other. But that's the subject of my next lecture. Thank you. It's a big thing. I just chewed off a big piece of American history, so I wouldn't wonder if you. Yeah. I think it's 60%. I got to check.
before.
6% of the
25%? Yeah. Other people do too, by the way.
Other people?
Other, I mean, non-evangelicals also believe in the rapture. I mean, it's amazing, but for some churches, the rapture is doctrine. Fundamentalist churches, most Pentecostal churches, the whole scenario is doctrine. But other people simply pick up this narrative, and I'll describe the narrative next week. For the end times, the end of the world. And so it's sort of diffused in the culture.
Thanks so much. Maybe you're going to take this up next week, but you skip over a lot. That is from the end of the Civil War, thereabouts, up to Jimmy Carter. So in between, there is industrialization, the progressive movement, the New Deal, etc. But just to focus on the
late next week. Next
upset.
Week.
Okay. No,
but it's what. Well, that's part of the split, and that's modernism and social gospel are essentially with the sort of left-wing side of the Protestant equation in the late 19th century. We'll get there. But I thought this was interesting because, oddly enough, Most evangelical history is now done by evangelical historians, and there are some really good ones, but they never seem to look at the whole picture. And non-religious, right, new evangelicals, look back to Finney as somebody who ought to be part of their tradition. And they say, where did that go? Where did Finney's social reformism go in our tradition? Well, the answer was it went into mainline Protestantism, but they won't hear about that. So, and this is true of both secular and other historians, rarely look at both the South and the North at the same time. It's always one or the other. And, Southern historians sort of live in their own sort of a little ghetto, I'm afraid. So nobody listens to them. So evangelicalism is often, the history is often only the Northern history. Whereas the South today, most evangelicals used to live in the South. I mean, the beginning of this century, the beginning of last 20th century. And today, 50% of them do. So that's a very important part of evangelicalism. Yeah. Yeah.
In your work, have you done field work among sounds where you have among evangelicals? Have you spoken with them? Have you done any research? And how do you deal with the issue of the difference between your views? It's clear that you are not someone who shares their views. How do you deal with that, and how do they deal with it?
I'm a journalist. I speak to a lot of people whose views I don't share, and I just ask questions. I spent a long time in 1980 in Jerry Falwell's church community. A long time. I spent 3 weeks at once, another week, another here and there. And that was hard interviewing because everybody would spend the first half hour trying to convert me. And, I try and wiggle out of this conversation, but it almost couldn't be done. So that, but it was part of the thing. This doesn't happen anymore. I have not, since, in recent years, I have not run into this again. I'm sure that if, I was in an intimate conversation with somebody for a long period of time, they might then introduce it, but never, bang, flat, just on meeting the way it used to be. Otherwise, I've never had any trouble talking with people, and um, first of all, Americans love to be interviewed. I think that's one main thing. And these people aren't that interviewed all that much. So I think it's sort of, they, you know, everybody likes to be appreciated. But it took me a while to be able to speak their language well enough so that they wouldn't be offended by my language as I was offended by their language initially. Yeah.
While these trends were happening in the United States, the Two Great Awakenings, what was going on among European Protestants?
Well, they too had their awakenings, and it was the Methodists again in England that made the most important impact there. But what's interesting about European churches is that the Anglican Church, the Lutherans, and so forth, is they are all established churches, right? And they remain so today. And they've shown a tremendous ability to adapt and include. I mean, that's the way. Why Episcopalians are the way they are, but while Methodists, that's my background. While the Methodists made an important impact in England, and there's very much of a Methodist church there now, the Anglican Church tended to sort of co-opt people. They included their sort of Pietistic traditions within the Anglican tradition. And Nathaniel Hatch makes this point, which I think is important also. It's not just that this country became a sort of marketplace of religious ideas in the way that European countries were not in the sense of being an established church. But always there's been this push to convert the poor. And essentially in England, the Methodists gave up on that after a bit. I mean, not entirely, I'm being too broad and general here, you know, always there's been movements in the society. If people are left out, preachers go for them.
Yeah. There's a question over here.
Sure. I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, 2,500, and it's interesting that you have this split you emphasize between the North and the South within a little town like that, where you had four Main Street churches, the Methodist, the Presbyterian, the Lutheran, the Baptist, and then the cotton mills were one block off Main Street parallel to it, and all of those people went to the Holiness and the Church of God and shouted and screamed, and it was like the respectable churches were on Main Street and the true evangelists were one block away. And we used to go home from church and you would go to, you know, you had a regular organist and you sang and a preacher gave a regular sermon, and then you would hear these people howling a block away.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, the Holiness churches and the Pentecostal churches came out of the Methodist tradition. They came out of it because they found the Methodists had lost their sort of supernaturalist juice, you know. And they went for very working class people. Pentecostals, of course, included blacks as well as white Americans, and they're, you know, major black Pentecostal churches, and few maybe, but anyway, it's an exception to the rule. Some mixed congregations, even in the South. So, and it's the fastest. Pentecostal is the fastest growing religious movement in the world today. But it's got juice. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, here's one of them, very simple. I remember an administrator in one of Jerry Falwell's, his college at the time, he now is a university, but the college administrator said proudly, we are going to have a Christian football team that's as good as that of Notre Dame. So one had to be careful about such things, you know. And from the other point of view, the religious right doesn't like to be called the religious right. They like to be called Christians, period. I mean, it's not, religious right is not a phrase in their vocabulary. So, you know, you end up talking about conservative evangelical, something like that. It's very interesting how evangelicals are now trying to negotiate this language, because some of them are again making claims to being Christians in a different way than the religious right did. So they have to be very careful about how they deal with it. And it's an acquired thing. Oh, definitely so, and perhaps I should have made it more explicit, but, you know, Lorenzo Dow, right, could be any of those holiness preachers that you know, were listening to or not listening to. This enormous drama, the speaking of the common language, the adoption of popular culture, which is what they all did. Popular culture then, they preached, and they're preaching it now. They're preaching in the language of popular culture a lot, but also with the technology. I mean, George Whitefield used the press. These people use television, use the internet, vast mega churches, because after all, numbers are important, you know. Numbers have always been terribly important. I'm sort of kept a little off that, because really I guess these lectures are more about politics than they are about church practices and so forth, but I was hoping you could hear it coming out, resonating, and There's again the sort of anti-intellectualism in much of the evangelical world comes out of here, you know. That's it. Yeah.
I guess I'm having a little bit of a hard time focusing and separating this part of the religious right that's not overlapping with the evangelicals.
I'll help you later on. This is not it.
Okay. All right.
If you wouldn't mind coming back and back. And actually, the third lecture is probably more the most sort of directly. I mean, the second lecture is about how the religious right came into being. What is it? Where did it come from? Okay. And what makes it different from simply conservative Christianity? And what makes it different from conservatives, period, you know, secular conservatives. So look how it's moved on. But the third lecture is about these new guys who since 64 have been making it clear. I mean, just as a constituency, evangelicals don't poll the same, you know. Not until 2004, nobody that counted, three people that counted, but only three, stood up and said, look, this is not what we ought to be doing as evangelicals. Now everybody's all over the place, they're saying it. So that's what I'm going to go into.
There's a question here on the over here.
I understand that race is really crucial to understanding, right here, yes, to understanding conservative evangelicalism. Do you think that the way that race really disabled an ability to critique social institutions had an impact to critique economics or the political institutions around them as well?
I hope I was made that clear. I hope I did. Maybe I went too fast. But no, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. I mean, all these other reform efforts in the South just stopped because a critique of anything was going to be seen as a critique at that point of slavery, later on of segregation. And next week I'll be talking about how the civil rights movement extricated Southern churches from their political passivity, Southern white churches, for better or worse.
Forgive me, I'm tired. I cannot remember the name of the person who came from England.
Whitfield.
Okay. Was that the first revival?
Yeah.
That phenomenon of the response that was evoked by what he was saying, that was so catchy, apparently. What's the underlying dynamic there? I mean, was it the power of suggestion, or is that possible to...
One has to think oneself back into a Calvinist frame of mind a sort of Puritan Calvinist frame of mind to see what's going on here. And, you know, essentially, Puritan Calvinism had to do with small communities. Here we're in a growing city, actually, you know, Philadelphia wasn't that big. It was, I think, 2,000 people, but that seemed like a lot to, you know, in the 1740s. And so people growing up with all this back in their heads, but unable to work out a life that looked anything like their parents' lives. And so there was this guilt involved. But I mean, if you're asking me to sort of really get into what people are going through as they experience this conversion experience, I'd say, as Barack Obama did in Rick Warren's church, it's beyond my pay grade. Yeah.
When did phenomena like the handling of snakes and speaking in tongues and other ways of giving evidence of conversion or presence of the spirit, or however you might. When did that emerge? Was that a 19th century phenomenon?
Absolutely, 19th century, late 19th century. Or I don't know, who knows what was happening in the mountains all over, but it's very much about, it's about the gifts of the spirit, and the gifts of the spirit evidence themselves in speaking in tongues, in faith healing, also in handling snakes. If they, you know, if they don't bite you, then clearly you're okay. Yes, what? Perhaps we should, that should be it.
I know of Jonathan Edwards as the grandfather of Aaron Burr, but I don't know that much about Jonathan Edwards. Could you?
Well, that is a very long story, I'm sorry to say, because he has been so well and beautifully written about by all the great scholars of this country from Perry Miller on, so I wouldn't really dare to, but I mean, he's mainly known as a theologian and a great writer, what actually impressed me about him recently, I mean, just reading this, was that he had a when he was at Yale, he had his terrible struggle accepting the lack of human free will, accepting that God controlled everything. And he had this conversion, walking out in a pasture and looking up at the blue sky and the green trees all around him. And he said, okay, God, you did it all, essentially. And that was really it. And that's what he was really talking about, is it being a religion starting from the emotions as opposed to some rational thing.
That might be a great note to end on and go on next week into the religious right and why it grew. So thank you very much.